Stratus Foods is the industry partner you can depend on when you're looking for the very best in fats and oils. Our team of expert researchers, developers, and innovators have helped countless businesses just like yours bring their delicious menus to life. With products that are reliable, sustainable, and ready to meet any challenge, you can fry, bake, saute, and grill with confidence. Stratus Foods, we've got you covered.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Extra Serving, a podcast from Nation's Restaurant News. I'm Sam Okus, editor-in-chief of NRN, joined once again by my twinner today, executive editor Alicia Kelso. Alicia, it's a very green day today.
It is, unplanned.
Unplanned, but oh so, I don't know, fun and whimsical for a Friday.
Spring-like.
It's very spring-like, yes. And as you mentioned, we're both trying to get our eyes to pop. So for those of you who are on YouTube, just look closely. Okay, anyway, I won't get creepy on you guys. We have to start, Alicia, by talking about our power list. We just put out our power list this week. This is an annual list that NRN's done for many, many years, done before you and I got here. And for many years, the power list was framed as a traditional, here are the most powerful people in food service. We started playing around with the definition about 5 years ago, and instead of just focusing on the most powerful people, who unfortunately is just a bunch of white men, we started to explore some other angles. And so that has included innovators, that has included influencers. This year, we're very excited for the power list to be themed Women in Food Service, and we have 52 women on that list who are, as we say, chipping away at the glass ceiling, I guess you could say, to use a cliche. Alicia, it feels kind of ridiculous that in 2025 we have to do this, but why do we have to have a list like this year?
Yeah, I think the statistics speak for themselves in this industry in particular. We over-index on frontline. I think we're above... are right at 65%. Servers are higher. But then when you work your way up the proverbial ladder, that dissipates significantly to around 23%. And then the C-suite, woof, C-suite is horribly underrepresented. And so it can't be overstated that the representation of decision makers does not equal the people actually doing the work. And that does not even account for the consumer set. Women make most of the buying decisions. That is a fact, household buying decisions, including especially mealtime. And so, when the representation is non-existent at the table, at the decision-making table, you know, that becomes a challenge. So I think that's as simple as it is. Representation matters. I'll die on that hill.
Yeah, 100%. When we settled on this, I wrote about this in the editor's letter, which we'll post. I think today I'm going to post that on LinkedIn as part of our newsletter. But I was highly conscious of the fact that sometimes when you make a list of women doing things, it feels like, you know, you want to do things based on merit. You don't want to have to do things based on gender. I was remembering in 2013, I dug up this tweet from Anthony Bourdain, the late, great Anthony Bourdain, who at the time there was a 50 world's best women chefs, I think was the list. There was an outcry about why isn't it just the 50 best chefs? Why do you have 50 best women chefs? Because men and women should be considered, on the same plane with, for their merit. And the tweet from Anthony Bourdain said, as if women are curiosities, as if it's to say like, oh, well, they only belong on their own list. We don't want to consider them for the regular list. That's where all the men belong, right? That was what I was thinking of when we initially settled on this decision, because I don't want that to come across as, well, we have to make the list of the women so they feel good about this. That's not the point, right? The point of why we really did settle on, yes, we have to make this list, is because we have to show the change that has to happen, right? By putting together this list of 52 women, it's to say, look at these 52 people who have done it. We should have more women like them. And the only way we can do that is if we emulate them and their careers. If we model after, for example, Habit Burger and El Pollo Loco and Whataburger that have these C-suites full of dynamic and powerful women, and we have to fill the pipeline with more women leaders just like them to be able to take this. So, that's what ultimately what we're trying to accomplish here. The goal is to say, To your point, Alicia, representation is far, far, is woefully short for women in executive positions. We found 52 women in executive positions who are demonstrating that they can bring incredible change to their businesses and do incredible things in their businesses. And we want that the gender parity gap to be closed, because we think that that representation will be a good thing on balance for the restaurant industry. So that's why we did that. Were there any highlights for you from this year?
Yeah, if I can back up real quick, I think in my personal experience, I was on stage last year at the Texas Restaurant Association alongside three other women, and we were talking on a panel about some of the challenges that female executives have had to deal with. And a 16-year-old who just started in the industry stood up when we were done speaking and just started bawling. And she's like, I never thought I would see this. Like, I never thought. And she's 16, like, holy cow. Like, I think my big takeaway from this is why we have a Women in Food Service program, to platform powerful women all year round, not just on the power list, not just in March. This is why we have a partnership with the Women's Food Service Forum. My big takeaways there from everybody I talk to is the empowerment of, if you can see it, you can do it. And I think this list is a testament exactly to that. My highlights, of course, you know, I had the privilege of talking to the women of Habit, who are so great. And just, you know, El Pollo Loco, Whataburger, seeing a lot of these C-suites really either at parity or really close to parity, which is still very unusual. And then being on these group interviews with them and hearing them, you know, just boost each other up. In fact, El Pollo Loco, we wanted to feature all the women on their C-suite, and they said, nope, you need to focus on Jill Adams, the CMO, because we're in the middle of a brand transformation, and she's carrying the brunt of that work. And they just were like, move out of the way. So we just kind of featured them, you know, very briefly. And then I talked to Jill and she's, you know, obviously in the spotlight on our photo. And I think that just underscores exactly what we're talking about in terms of women working together, lifting each other up, empowering each other, cheering for each other, advocating, mentoring, all of it. It's just, it's kumbaya to me. I love it. I could talk about it all day, but I know that we don't have the time.
Yes, unfortunately, we do not. But El Pollo Loco, a good segue into getting into some headlines.
You're welcome.
By the way, before we jump into that, though, I do want to say I'm going to put the link to the power list in the show notes. Do go check it out. 52 women. You need to meet these women because, again, the examples they are setting for the power of women in food service, in specifically executive positions, is incredible. And, you know, I think a lot of them have some very strong, actionable, practical advice for how to close that gap and why we should. So I dig into this because, you know, this is not just a here's 52 women, click, 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 click. This is a get to know them and understand what their advice is for the industry going forward, because it is a good thing. And I think every company should take steps to close that parity gap. Okay. El Pollo Loco was in the news this week, not just because of the power list, but also because Sardar Biglari and Biglari Holdings have made an offer to acquire El Pollo Loco. If you do not know who that is, Sardar Biglari fancies himself as the next coming of Warren Buffett. He idolizes Warren Buffett, the sage of Omaha, and he has tried to put into practice Warren Buffett's strategies, I guess, of assembling companies under his portfolio, but with a little bit more brute force than Warren Buffett. If you know anything about Warren Buffett, he is just seems like a teddy bear. I just want to hug him. But Sardar Biglari, less so. Sardar Biglari owns Steak and Shake, was his probably entry into this industry, I think, in first place that everybody got to know him. And then he acquired a majority stake in Cracker Barrel, which is a company that he has battled with over the years. I think I'm wrong about that. I don't know if he has a majority stake, but he has a good big share. He's a
he wants a majority stake, he's been denied seven times. He's a proxy king.
He's largest shareholder trying to become majority shareholder, and now he has his eyes on El Pollo Loco. Which, in fact, I didn't really realize this, but in 2023, El Pollo Loco adopted a poison pill. You wrote about this, Alicia, in order to protect against him, which Cracker Barrel 2 had done at one point in time. The idea being you set a standard basically higher to for anybody to come in, swoop in and acquire the majority shares in order to prevent that person from taking over, essentially. I'm not smart enough to understand all the ins and outs of this. I go Google it. But the point is Sardar Bhaglari is a fairly controversial character in our industry, partly because of his approach to changing the brands he acquires and sort of asserting himself into them. Steak and Shake being a very prime example. I believe there remains a photo of him hanging in the entryway to every Steak and Shake, I think. It's a thing. So everybody's going to have opinions, but Alicia, tell me more about what's going on specifically with Sardar Bhaglari's intentions with El Pollo.
Yeah, so he made an unsolicited indication to buy the rest of the shares for El Pollo Loco that he doesn't already own, which is about... Gosh, that you don't pay me to do math, but I think it's about 85%. I think he's currently just Zero. Above 15%. So as you mentioned, that 15% was acquired in 2023, and that's when they adopted that poison pill. There was a confidentiality agreement put into place between Bhaglari Holdings and El Pollo Loco. So we really don't have very many details at this point. But we know that there's no timeline that's been set. And we know that El Pollo Loco is, quote, carefully evaluating this agreement proposal. I think the timing is what it is. You know, El Pollo Loco is in the middle of an aggressive turnaround plan. I think they're on year two. Their unit growth has been pretty stagnant. But the unit economics themselves are definitely moving in the right direction under CEO Liz Williams, who came on board in 23, I believe. Sales last year were up 4.3%. You know, they've been a rare positive same-store sales performer in the quick service industry throughout the past couple of quarters. You know, we're zigging while many others have been zagging. Average unit volumes are up. Liz and her team put in an aggressive margin improvement plan into place last year. And that has found a lot of traction. So unit economics are getting stronger. I think the impatience is coming from that stagnant unit growth, but I am a firm believer that the unit economics should come first before a unit growth. And that's exactly what's happening. We talked about the turnaround plan under Jill Adams's purview, the branding. They're launching new products for the first time in, you know, like a decade. Who knows what's going to come of this? We know Bhaglari is certainly aggressive. He's been aggressive fruitlessly with Cracker Barrel 7 times. 7 proxy fights with Cracker Barrel, which is just kind of stunning and I think wasteful, you know, and I almost feel for Cracker Barrel having to defend itself and spend money on that kind of stuff. You know, Steak and Shake is not exactly the poster brand of successful companies, and
quite the opposite in his tenure, in fact.
Correct. And so there, you know, that can merit some opinions that I am not paid to have opinions, but that could merit some opinions. And Steak and Shake is really in an interesting spot now, in addition to all of this, because they're really taking an aggressive stance on this, you know, Make America Healthy Again thing with their beef tallow fries and a weird social media presence and putting their logos on cyber trucks and all this stuff. Politics aside, it's strange for any brand to cohesively attach itself to something that is egregiously political. So who knows? I mean, like I said, he's got the history. He had an activist campaign against Friendlies, to your point, that I think that came before Steak and Shake. So he just likes to do this stuff, I guess.
Yeah, and it's
I don't know if he gets bored or what.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one thing again where again just to, so I wrote this story in 2011 about Sardar Bhaglari for my previous employer, and I swear that story still bubbles up. I mean, it was for years and years and years one of the top things we had done at QSR, because it was just people are interested in him. And so I did an in-depth on him. He did not participate, did not want to, declined to participate. And so I solicited enough information around him that I was able to put this piece together. And I mean, again, the Warren Buffett thing is important to touch on here because he really models himself after Warren Buffett. Now, Warren Buffett, of course, owns Dairy Queen. And this was something that he loved it as a kid. He wanted to come in and he loves getting his ice cream, Warren Buffett, and has done fairly well for Dairy Queen. And I think Sardar Biglari thinks, oh, hey, I'm going to go acquire an iconic restaurant chain in America and do the same thing. But again, if you look at what Steak and Shake has done in the last now 15 years, it has been about as opposite of what it probably should have done as you could be, because it's 90-year-old brand, something 80 to 90-year-old brand out of Indiana, real meat and potatoes kind of brand, not necessarily on the menu. Potatoes anyway, but like, you know, it's real Midwest iconic kind of chain. And there was a way he could have embraced that identity to bring it back into what now Culver's has been able to accomplish. And even Shake Shack has been able to accomplish. Five Guys very quietly can accomplish. Steak and Shake has not done that. And so to me, you look at what he's accomplished for that brand. There's a reason these other chains are scared of him coming in, because there's not any kind of proof here yet to show that he's validated it, right? So that's what's going on here. It's interesting because Cracker Barrel, another power list shout out here, Julie Felsmacino, CEO at Cracker Barrel, is also on the power list. Also, like Liz Williams, came from Taco Bell. And I don't know if there's any sort of weird connective thing between all of this or if it's just coincidence, but Cracker Barrel is in a great spot right now. They've done pretty well for themselves. Sardar Biglari has seats on the board, but again, is not fully in the driver's seat on that. So I'm not in the know enough of Cracker Barrel to understand whether he's brought anything to the table for them. And I think the controversy between those two sides has cooled. But it's just fascinating to see him turn his attention to El Pollo Loco, because again, if history has anything to say about what's going to come next, it could get ugly for El Pollo Loco. And so that's what I think we should watch from here on.
I agree. And I was just, I was looking at social media fodder about this move this week to gauge other people's opinions, since I don't get paid to have opinions. And I can confidently say that the overall consensus is that please don't let this happen. He will ruin it. And I don't know. Again, I think proxy fights are, you know, can be productive and have been productive in the past. I don't think seven proxy fights with Cracker Barrel has been productive. Time is going to tell what happens here, but this is just kind of annoying to talk about.
Yeah, and that's why we're going to move along as much as we can. Okay, for the sake of time, Alicia.
That's an opinion. I'm sorry.
But no, okay. Hey, you know what? That's what podcasts are for. So yeah, we're going to skip ahead a little bit. I want to make sure we touch on the state of the economy. I mean, relevant to everything we've been talking about so far. And we're going to be talking about the economy all year long, folks. So buckle in. Alicia, you wrote this great piece on the Consumer Price Index. And of course, if you're paying attention to the economy today, you know, obviously, about what's going on with tariffs. You might also know that technically in March, inflation cooled slightly. Don't buy into the hype, because it is likely to shoot very far back upward in April because of tariffs. Inevitably, whether you think they're right or wrong, tariffs and what they're doing to the stock market right now are almost guaranteed to drive inflation up. But what else did you deduce from the latest Consumer Price Index report, Alicia?
To your point, it was overall positive news in March with that better than expected cooling of inflation. That was driven by energy prices. Food prices had a completely different story. And that includes both restaurant and grocery, both of which were up. And so for the sake of this discussion, that's not great. You know, egg prices are now at a record high as of March. And we thought that this would move in a different direction. The avian flu has kind of subsided a little bit, and yet egg prices are still at a record high. Beef is also rising. We know that's a concern for many, if not most of the brands that we cover. And menu prices are up. You know, especially in the full service segment, they ticked up, I think, more than expected in March. if there's positive news for restaurants, it's that they are closing the gap a little bit with grocery. Grocery has had a lot of favor in recent months in having lower inflation than restaurants, and that gap closed just a skosh in March because of those egg prices and beef prices, you know, in the aisles. This is, I think, you know, those are March numbers. To your point, the tariff conversation and the anticipated inflation coming from the tariffs. And I know that we're on a 90-day pause now for most of the countries that were impacted with the tariffs, but we're not for China. We have seen the volatility in the stock market in real time. Most major economists have come out and said that we are going to hit a recession if we're not already in one. And then couple that with the University of Michigan survey that just came out today, which is, as we're recording this, Friday, it just plunged. Oh, it was shocking how much it plunged. And now consumers are mostly worried about inflation, again, driven by the tariff noise. And those concerns about inflation are at the highest level since 1981. So you'd have to go back to the Reagan era to understand how consumers are feeling. This is across all, you know, all demographics. And I think there's a lot of things, there's a confluence of things that are feeding into this. Negative headlines, you know, one thing, dizzying policy changes in real time. A lot of us watched our 401ks literally evaporate before our eyes last week. Layoffs are dominating headlines, both in the private and public sector. Wage rates are flatlining. And of course, the debilitating uncertainty over tariffs in general. And you know, I think the most important point here is Walmart, everybody from Walmart to Delta Airlines. And then just this week, Technomic, which, you know, focuses on restaurant data, has shifted guidance downward. So Technomic, as it pertains to that 2025 outlook, came into the year expecting about 5.1% increase in sales this year. And they have adjusted that down to 2.8 to 4.2. That's a pretty big adjustment.
Big. Yeah.
We're getting ready to head into earnings season. We're going to have a hell of a lot more information now, not just for Q1, which we kind of expect to be a little bit of a bloodbath because weather was certainly more of a factor than it's been in recent years. But because we're going to get some peek into early weeks of Q2. And I'm really interested in what that is going to yield.
Yeah, and I know you mentioned on our Slack channel, I mean, expect to hear the word uncertainty just ad nauseum for the next weeks, many weeks and months. And I was on a call with our friends from Technomic a few days ago. We were talking about, you know, that shift in their guidance for the year. And they said they're going to have really kind of three because they said there's sort of going to be a high, middle, low because, again, because of uncertainty, it is so impossible to understand where things go from here. And so they're just kind of, here's a range. It's going to be, you know, somewhere sort of best case scenario, worst case scenario, maybe somewhere in between. Uncertainty is where all companies are right now, because really we just don't know. But particularly even if tariffs on the rest of the world remain paused beyond the 90 days, even if the tariffs on China remain, that will affect the restaurant industry still because of how many goods are produced in China. And even if your company does not directly source anything from China, chances are your providers do, right? So all of this, there is a real trickle down effect, but we just do not know. Now, Alicia, you wrote a story about a brand that talked a lot about uncertainty, and it was more of an emerging brand. And I know you had some thoughts about where emerging brands in particular, some of the smaller chains fall in all of this. Unfortunately, they might be the victim in all of this.
Maybe. And I did report on Kura Sushi this week. They were down same store sales 5.3%, including negative 8.5% on traffic. A lot of that was driven by weather, because again, this was a Q1 situation and they have a pretty big California footprint. So they were impacted by wildfires as well. But to our earlier point, they are providing commentary early days on now what, and uncertainty is the early word of this next round of earnings. Somebody asked them if they led into that because of the tariffs. Somebody asked if they could source their stuff from or domestically because or to sort of mitigate that uncertainty. And their CEO said, well, you know, you can't catch tuna on Lake Erie. And so I think there might be a, well, can't you just do this?
Can't domestic? You just serve walleye?
Yeah. But, you know, I think this has way more to do. And we talked about this last week. This has way more to do than just food. It has equipment, construction materials, all of it. We're not just going to magically, you know, start manufacturing all of that stuff here. It's just not feasible. And what struck me the most about Kura's call is what concerns me the most about this uncertainty. And that is their CEO saying, hey, this is going to impact us, but we are in a much better spot than the mom and pops, the independents, because, you know, while we're anticipating about $400,000 impact on equipment, we can afford that. We've got, you know, a strong balance sheet, a lot of cash on hand. And of course, Kura is sushi. So most of their competitors are independents. They don't have the pockets to protect themselves against those added costs coming from tariffs. So I worry that such an environment, the big are going to get bigger. I'm worried about the independent sector in this environment.
Yes, I agree with you there. Let's shift into perhaps not a more optimistic note, but a different note at the very least. Not wearing green today, our extra serving guest, managing editor Leanne Zinsmeister. Leanne, did you not get the memo on the green?
No, I got the memo about what to prepare to talk about, but I can't believe you forgot to mention wardrobe requirements.
I need to get better at this. Yeah, my bad. Here we are coordinating and forgot to loop you in. I'm so sorry. Well, Leanne, you're here to talk about some executive changes. Alicia and I have just gotten done talking about tariffs, the economy, and ouchie, not so good right now. But I think the executive changes, while not a direct reflection of what's going on in the economy, the winds are changing and, could be directly impacting some brands. One of the biggest by location count in the United States, Subway. That was a big news this week. Subway's president of North America, Doug Fry, announced that he would be stepping down. Leanne, should we read too much into this? I mean, when you're the biggest company by location count, that's pretty quick turnover, too. He was not in that position for long. Something could be in that.
You know, Subway in particular is such an interesting case study, and I don't know if it's reflective of like the wider economy or industry as a whole. But I mean, you look back, summer 2023, it was announced they would be purchased by Rourke. They had been looking for a buyer. That went on for a while. That sale was finalized about a year ago. In the fall, CEO John Chidsey steps down. Carrie Walsh is promoted to interim CEO. She's still in that role. It's still interim. So we're all kind of like waiting to find out what's going to happen to that position. And then, as you just said, the president of North America steps down, kind of gives a vague reason about wanting to pursue other personal passions, specifically using the word personal. The COO is taking over his responsibilities. They've got a new global chief marketing officer coming in. So just lots of changes. Subway, of course, for a long time has been slipping despite its long time status as having the most locations in the US. It is closing net locations every year, losing sandwich share. You know, anytime we post anything about Subway, people on social media say, you know, in the comments, why go to Subway when you can go to Jersey Mike's, Jimmy John's, Firehouse, some trendier sandwich places. And so Subway seems to me has been losing its footing for a while, and that doesn't seem to be changing with these recent executive moves. Mind you, this was the seventh president or CEO change in 2 weeks, just in restaurants.
Yep.
Just in the restaurant space. Only the second this week. There were five last week, including, I think, three in one day. Alicia, thank you so much for spending that week at the beach. That was a huge help.
Yep.
And I know you guys have talked extensively on this podcast about David Gibbs, but some of these are new CEO appointments, but some of them are opening up space, opening up jobs. Yum Brands obviously needs a new CEO next year. Twin Peaks has an open CEO role. So there's a lot going on, a lot of movement. The other CEO change this week was at Small Sliders. It was announced that Charles Watson would be stepping in. Now, he comes from Tropical Smoothie Cafe, which already has a new CEO in place. So there's not a new role there. But there are a lot of changes happening. And it does remind me of, was it just last summer when there was the like Wendy's, Shake Shack, Papa John's, like domino effect?
The
domino effect, but Domino's Pizza was not involved. Good catch. It makes me wonder if we're going to see some of those fall, or I don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty in a lot of different ways, which I know you guys have already talked about today, but also just like in terms of who's going to do these jobs.
It's always interesting to me. I know I'm with fellow football fans. Doesn't it ever feel like the sort of annual NFL coaching carousel when it's like the same people who just got fired go take another job at another company? Look, I'm not trying to throw shade at anybody here, but it is a fascinating thing that like this industry can be a little incestuous. Sometimes I just want to encourage these companies, hey, maybe look at some other industries. I don't know, just because especially if you're a company that's not doing very well, Subway, you know, maybe here's an opportunity to bring an outsider in to take a look at what's going on and bring some new perspective, because often that's the case is your leadership issue is that they just don't have the right perspective to get your company into the next phase. Subway is such a fascinating one because, again, this is formerly the second largest by sales brand in America just 10 years ago. It just got passed by Chipotle in the sales department. It is now the 9th largest chain, according to Technomic. Chipotle has passed it to become the 7th largest chain, pass it in Burger King. So Subway's sliding, not just closing a bunch of locations. Obviously, that leads to also a sales downward trajectory. But I can't pinpoint any one thing that they've done with their brand that was necessarily wrong. They've updated their branding in the last 5 to 10 years. They do a lot of athlete partnerships. They changed their menu to have some signature sandwiches. I think all the right thing. I just think they're a victim of so many great competitors out there with higher quality product, maybe don't lean into their value messaging as much as they should. They've lost a lot of the momentum that they previously had. So I understand how a leadership change may be necessary with that. Now, Alicia, what do you make of some of these changes? Well, I guess some of these changes, the two changes that happened this week. I know you were on top of the Smalls shift. Former CEO Maria Vera exited a few weeks ago. Charles Watson comes in. Charles Watson really did help take Tropical Smoothie from sort of middling chain to very significant prominent chain that got acquired by Blackstone. Seems like a pretty solid hire for a company of 20 plus locations in Small Sliders that has big ambition.
Yeah, I want to challenge something that you just said, and I'm not sure what Subway did wrong. And I think the pinpoint on that is they just cannibalized itself and offered franchisees to anyone who had a pulse and so overexpanded. And now I think we're seeing the spinning of that correction, if you will. And I also thought it was funny that you said this industry is incestuous when you and I both came from competitors. Anyway,
this has benefited some of us.
I looked it up before we jumped on this call. The average tenure for restaurant CEO is about 6.5 years. And so it's anomalous right now. And Leanne does such a great job keeping track of this where, you know, she put into the Slack, there were 10 CEO changes in March alone. And you look at the brands that are going through these leadership changes and the ones that are going through the most leadership changes, the Subways, you know, the Panera, P.F. Chang's, they're not doing great. So, I think Smalls is a completely different story that, you know, Maria was on board for a little bit longer than the turnover at those three brands. But then Smalls, you know, is such a promising emerging brand. And it always surprised me that they had about just less than 30 locations open. you know, they have a huge development pipeline. I think about 350 agreements signed. But my conversation with Charles Watson was really interesting. And there was kind of a subtlety in their shifting priorities to focus on unit economics first, and then sort of development second. And I think that is a shift. I think development was the first priority previously, and everything else as per their development pipeline indicates. And he has done that, just that, like we mentioned at Tropical Smoothie. It did shock me that their average unit volumes fell year over year when I looked at the Technomic data. Maybe that's a good shift. You know, if you want to grow that ambitiously to get to those 350 units, you don't want to go the wrong direction. You want to go you want to increase your average unit volume. So interesting times. I think the turnover at the top is a clear indication of just how challenging things are right now.
For sure. Okay, speaking of emerging brands that are exciting to watch. Decent segue, not a great segue, but I do want to also have Leanne tee us up for the interview that she did that we are going to roll into right now. Leanne, who did you speak with this week?
Yes, I spoke with Abby Taylor, the founder of Pliables. Pliables opened its first location beachside on the Jersey Shore in 2014 and was kind of on the front end of the acai trend. And so they, even opening up in 2014, a lot of what they had to do was education. This is what our product is. This is why you should buy it. And what's interesting to me is, like, being in the industry, I feel like the acai thing like came and went, and I can't imagine not being familiar with it as a product in 2025. However, as people, including yourselves, are so often remind me, not everyone lives in New York City and works in the restaurant industry. Unbelievably.
No, we are your flyover state colleagues here.
My point is that in talking to Abby, and mind you, Abby is also from the Northeast, but she pointed out that a lot of consumers across the U.S. Still don't necessarily know what they're getting into at a Pliables or a similar unit. So Pliables just opened its 300th location, and it is in Atlanta, which is a market where they are still doing a lot of this kind of education around their product. So we talked a lot about that. We talked about the menu and future plans and staying loyal to your brand as a founder who's still involved 11 years on. It was a really great conversation, so I'm excited to share that.
Very exciting, Leanne. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us on Extra Serving. Managing Editor Leanne Zinsmeiser, Executive Editor Alicia Kelso. Guys, talk to you next time.
All right. I'm here with Abby Taylor, the founder and chief brand officer of Pliables. Abby, thank you for joining me today.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Why don't you give me the quick pitch of what Pliables is and a quick overview of your journey so far for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with the brand?
Basically, Pliables is... we do bowls. Bowls is our thing, right? So we started with acai bowls in Belmar, New Jersey in 2014. And then our menu grew. We do pitaya bowls and a bunch of other different bases, smoothies, juices, something for everybody. But the brand started after college. I did a bunch of traveling. I've surfed my whole life. So I went to all the different surf spots that I dreamed of going to and was having versions of acai bowls and was obsessed. So I brought it back to the Jersey Shore, where I felt like there was a need for something healthy at the beach. And it took a little bit of educating and telling people what acai was and telling stories of my travels and all of that before people kind of caught on. But as soon as they did, I saw that we were definitely onto something.
Yeah. And you just opened your 300th store. Is that right? In Atlanta?
Yes. In Atlanta, in Buckhead. It was
amazing. That's exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
When you started that first store on the Jersey Shore, like, was this your vision? Did you think you would get up to 300? Like, what was, how did you feel about the future at that point? 10 yeah. years ago, 11.
It actually was like a cart on the side of the road, a totally illegal operation. It was like our friend's patio table, a Bamery topping station, some signage that I always did by hand, a big umbrella. So it wasn't even a storefront at that point. So absolutely not. I definitely didn't picture being in this position, but definitely saw a need for it in the market and saw that a lot of people wanted to franchise and love the brand and wanted to grow it with us. So it was a natural move. But no, I never thought that we would be here.
A lot of brands really struggle to like maintain their authenticity as they scale like this. And obviously Pliables, it sounds like, is a really personal brand for you. Not a lot of founders are still involved 11 years later. So how do you keep that culture and the mission and like what Pliables really is? How do you keep that like across the country at 300 different stores?
Yeah, this is something I definitely lose sleep over. It was really hard as we grew from, you know, 10 locations to 20 to 50 to 100, how to maintain that. But I think that social media really helped. People grew with us. They were at the cart with us on social media, and then they grew with us to that first location and then to all the milestones in between. So they were really part of that story, and it was really, you know, real. And I think they grew with us and they saw that this is, you know, a true story, an American dream that could happen to somebody if they work hard. So I think growing with us on social helped maintain that vibe and that culture. And then telling the story on social media and then in shop, we have menu boards and these boards when you walk in, telling the story of Pliables and keeping to reinforce that story of how the brand grew and where we started is really important, even at this point.
What are the biggest challenges in growing a brand, especially so quickly? I mean, 300 units in 11 years is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah. Like you said, definitely keeping that authenticity and keeping that vibe and that feel and that passion, especially when you let in all these franchise partners and new people and there's sort of, you know, new hires and people coming and going. So that's difficult, but making sure that you're telling the story and explaining how we got here and making sure people are understanding how Pliables started. And also the point that we really don't, all of our ingredients and all of our products are high quality, and we really never skimped out on that. And it was something that I was always really passionate about, was keeping that quality and maintaining that product the same as it was as the cart, and obviously evolving, but keeping that quality and not cutting corners is really important.
So you were talking about when you first got started and like having to explain what acai bowls are to people. I feel like that's probably something you have to do less now. It become somewhat trendy, very popular. So how do you like stand apart from competitors? Because it's a much more crowded space than it was when you got your start.
Yeah. Well, just going back to that education, I would make flyers at Staples and put a little sign up at the cart, and it was right across the street from the beach. And I would hand out flyers at the beach explaining what acai was. And at that point, especially, you know, 11 years ago at this point, no one knew what acai was, especially at the Jersey Shore, which now I think a lot of people do, like you said, but now we're going into new markets across the US and those people have no idea. So it's almost like starting over, boots on the ground, getting into the community, handing out this information, telling the story, telling what acai is and the benefits of it. And what really sets us apart, like I said, is the quality of our bowls and all of our products. And I think also the vibe when you're in shop, we bring up the word vibe a lot in meetings and when we're talking about Pliables. And I think it's something that other people can't recreate. And it definitely because it's authentic to us and we're not pretending to be anybody. This is who we've been since day one. And that's really something that sets us apart.
How do you, or how does the brand approach menu innovation? I'm thinking specifically of the way, like, there are always so many different, like, trendy, like, diets. do you try to keep up with those kind of trends and stuff? Or how do you approach menu innovation, deciding when and how to introduce new menu items? Or do you just, like, stick with what you know and what you have?
We've definitely stuck to the acai thing and really pushed that. And I think we have down the line sort of made some adjustments to, you know, speak to people's diets or what's trendy. And there is a point where you want to stay trendy and you want to keep kind of with the times and keep innovating, but also looking back at like, what are your core products that make you special? And it might not be something totally new. It might just be educating about the products that are really great that are already on our menu. So definitely pivoting with that. And not trying to get ahead of ourselves and always trying to create something new when it's like the stuff on our menu is really what is our bread and butter.
Is there anything in particular like coming to the menu or any trends going on in the industry that you're like particularly excited about?
I can't really tell you, but yes, things are coming to the menu. Like I said, we are kind of pivoting and focusing on our core products and explaining and educating, especially in new markets where they don't know what acai is and they don't know about the story of Pliables. But we do have some exciting things that are coming onto our menu that are sort of keeping up with the space, but putting our own twist on it as we do as Pliables really well. So
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. I asked a yes or no question and you said yes. So that's okay. How do you decide when you're growing, like what markets to go into? Because like Jersey Shore, right at the beach, like makes a lot of sense to me. But you're in Atlanta now. Like, how do you decide on Atlanta or wherever you're going next?
So in the beginning, it really was gut feelings and people were approaching us and sending in, you know, that they wanted to become franchisees. And it was in all these different states and different markets that we had no clue about. But now we have teams of people that are looking into that and doing research and where are these people going and what's the demographic and what is the population and all of those things. Is it by a college? Is it by, you know, office buildings or whatever it is? So we do have more data and more people kind of doing that at this point. But in the beginning, it was a lot of gut feeling and relationships.
And I think you have 90 more locations planned for 2025. Is that right?
Yes.
So not slowing down at all. If anything, picking up the pace. What are you excited about in this like next phase of growth for Pliables?
So definitely on the East Coast and especially Jersey, we have like a really big name for ourselves and people know what it is. It's a household name. You know, people are kind of going into other acai shops and ordering a Pliable, which is really cool. But sort of planting our flags in the rest of the states as we move across the country and having that same feel and that same recognition across the U.S. is going to be really huge for us in the next few years and this year in particular.
What advice would you give other founders who might be looking to scale a business, but while also staying true to their vision as you have?
Definitely surrounding yourself with people who have been in this industry and really know their stuff. Having a good team around you is so helpful, and being able to go to them and, you know, they've been through this and they've kind of done this before. And some of them have done it at numerous brands, right? So relying on your people and being surrounding yourself with good stuff like that, but also being a founder and being in the room and being that strong voice for the brand. You've been here since day one. Like, you are the brand. You should be in the room kind of speaking up and keeping everybody on track and making sure that you all align so that the growth is really as successful as it can be.
Is there like one moment in the last, you know, since you first launched Pliables, is there like one thing that stands out to you as like your proudest achievement with the brand?
There's so many things that make me feel like that. Definitely watching people who worked with us at the cart or in the first few shops, and now they're, you know, working for us on the corporate team and have moved up and have teams of people below them, and watching the growth of people internally as they grow in the organization, as we grow, has been really rewarding. Meeting some amazing franchisees that we brought into our community that really wholeheartedly just jumped in, believed in Pliables, put everything on the line and love it so, so, so much is really gratifying. Those two things are really huge. It's amazing.
Of course, it really is. What are you most excited about the future? Either something specific or like 5 years from now, or like what excites you?
Like I said, definitely filling in those spots across the U.S. in places where we aren't at all, or in states where we don't have a ton of location, and having that recognition that we have on the East Coast and really owning who we are and, you know, the original acai shop and sort of planting that flag and setting the bar of what that is.
Awesome. Anything else that you'd like to share or talk about today?
No, I'm just really, really excited for our growth and super excited about where Pliables is today. And we're in such a good spot. And I think we're just going to keep crushing it and keep spreading across the U.S. And I don't see us stopping anytime soon. And we have a really good team around us. And this is going to be a huge year for us.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining me today, Abby.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Stratus Foods is the industry partner you can depend on when you're looking for the very best in fats and oils. Our team of expert researchers, developers, and innovators have helped countless businesses just like yours bring their delicious menus to life. With products that are reliable, sustainable, and ready to meet any challenge, you can fry, bake, saute, and grill with confidence. Stratus Foods, we've got you covered.